Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Tuesday, August 1st, 2017. We'll begin with Dwayne Jun. On Monday afternoon, he was shot dead by an NYPD officer who was involved in a previous shooting. The officer, 27-year-old Miguel Gonzalez of the 67th Precinct in Brooklyn, fired five shots at the 32-year-old inside of his apartment. That's where he lived with his parents. Jun's mom says her son suffered from being bipolar. One cop fired a stun gun. The police say Jun kept advancing and lunged at officers with a knife when he was shot dead by Gonzalez. Here's the police account from Terry Monahan this afternoon. He's chief of patrol.
This is still an ongoing investigation, but we have more information based on these interviews. What we know now is that our officers responded to the door. All four officers are at the door. Mr. June's mother opens the door for them. They enter the apartment. As they enter the apartment, Mrs. June runs to the back of the apartment yelling, "He's back here, he's back here." Officer Gerlachowski was the first officer into the apartment. He was armed with a taser. All four officers enter the apartment. Once they're in the living room area, Mr. June comes running out of the back directly at Officer Gerlachowski. Officer Gerlachowski starts to backpedal and fires the taser, striking Mr. June in the chest and in the arm. Mr. June continues forward into Officer Gerlachowski, knocking him prone onto the floor. He then straddles over him with the knife in his hand. At that point, Officer Gonzalez fires five rounds, striking Mr. June, causing his demise.
That officer, Miguel Gonzalez, was involved in another shooting of a man with a mental health difficulty, 23-year-old Devont Presley in Canarsie, who, like Jun, was diagnosed with bipolar disease, which Chief James O'Neill doesn't seem to know about.
Officer Gonzalez was involved in a prior shooting where someone called 911 on themselves, stating that they had a gun and a knife. That didn't come over as, Terry, correct me if I'm wrong, it didn't come over as an emotionally disturbed person. There was video of that incident.
You mean the previous incident?
Yeah, the previous incident. Right. Officer Gonzalez, it has not been finalized for our force investigation division, but it will be shortly, and we see that shooting as within guidelines.
The police department responds to about 150,000 calls each year for what the agency calls emotionally disturbed people. O'Neill says the NYPD continues to implement crisis intervention training for officers. Brooklyn Council member Jamani Williams released a statement saying that his thoughts and prayers continue to go out to the friends and family of Dwayne Jun. Officers are often put in harrowing situations, says Williams, and in this case, it appears decisions had to be made in a matter of seconds. That's why it's important that responders to emotionally disturbed persons are equipped to handle the situation. A specific set of skills and sensitivity is needed when dealing with people who are some of the people in need the most. My office, says Jamani Williams, is continuing to look into the protocol of this particular incident and whether the current protocol overall in the department is sufficient. We have now seen too many deaths, he says, with the same description. Until we get further information, he asks that we continue to keep our prayers with the family. This shooting death brings to mind others who died in similar circumstances, people with mental illness reaching out for help who end up dead, folks like Deborah Danner and Mohammed Ba, and now Dwayne Jun. Say their names. In other local news, Yadonis Rodriguez, chair of the New York City Council's Transportation Committee, and New York State Assembly member Jeffrey Dinowitz are going on a 24-hour subway ride dubbed a Rider's Response Tour. They will ride the trains in search of problems New Yorkers experience on the subway, and they are sure to find many. The City Council hearing on subways is scheduled for August 8th, and as usual, the public is invited. In other news, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's approval rating has plummeted, but he still has a big lead over his Republican challenger. This according to a Quinnipiac University poll. It says de Blasio's job approval rating is wilting in the summer heat. It now stands at 50% to 42%, down from 60% to 34% in mid-May. But he still tops Assemblymember Nicole Meliotakis from Staten Island, 57% to 22%. Here's de Blasio this afternoon.
I don't spend a lot of time trying to figure out my opponent's strategies. The things she talks about consistently show that she's out of touch with the values of New Yorkers. And for example, raising the question of bail reform, people all over the city want to see fewer people incarcerated with the right rules in place to make sure that public safety is preserved. They certainly want to see Rikers Island closed. She seems to be going the wrong direction there, both in terms of substance, but also in terms of the values of New Yorkers. So I don't think consistently saying things that people find to be the wrong position is going to get her very far. In terms of the poll, I've said this to you before, polls come, polls go. I'm never surprised the ways they go up or down. It's not just the famous hackneyed phrase, the only poll that matters is on election day. That is literally a true statement. And by the way, I think November 8th, 2016 was maybe the ultimate version of that, to be honest. And I really, really don't like what happened. But I think for all of us who have watched politics for a long time, that's the truth. We don't know anything until the people vote. But I never get caught up in the week-to-week or month-to-month variations. I think the bottom line is that people in this city are going to judge based on record. And today's an example. Crime is going down the city. Crime is going down our schools. Obviously, our schools are doing better by our kids, higher graduation rate, pre-K for all. We're creating affordable housing. These are the things that people want to see from the city of New York, and that's what I'll be running on.
De Blasio says Maliotakis' values are out of touch with New Yorkers. Maurice Carroll is assistant director of the Quinnipiac University poll. He asks, does the mayor deserve re-election? Voters are split right down the middle. Is he doing a good job as mayor? Yes, says 50% of voters on the standard traits, leadership, empathy, and honesty. All the numbers are down. Favorability for other mayoral candidates such as Sal Albanese or police reform candidate Bob Ganji weren't polled. But there was another poll for a New York native, Donald Trump. Trump's hometown neighbors disapprove 79% to 18% of the job he's doing, the lowest net approval rating for any president in any state or national poll conducted by Quinnipiac University in more than 20 years. Trump's stance on health care isn't helping with his approval ratings. He wants to let Obamacare implode by ending required payments to insurers. Today, Congressmember Carolyn Maloney, New York State Assemblymember Richard Gottfried, and others hosted a roundtable. It was focused on the future of health care in the U.S. Representative Maloney met patient advocate Peter Morley on Twitter. That's when her office was gathering stories of people who have health challenges. Today, he shared his story.
It's something that one of the reasons why we need an Affordable Care Act. I've had 9 surgeries in 10 years. I have 17 different doctors that manage my care. In 2007, I was disabled from a fall off of a ladder. I've had 3 failed spinal surgeries. I was diagnosed incidentally with kidney cancer in 2011. I lost part of my right kidney, but I fought my way into remission last year. I have had 2 neurosurgeries for a benign pituitary tumor, 2 carpal tunnel surgeries, 1 surgery to remove a malignant melanoma, and then in 2013, I was diagnosed with what has become my primary health concern to date, which is lupus. And for those of you who aren't familiar with lupus, I'm here to tell you it's an autoimmune disease. My immune system, when activated, creates autoantibodies that attack not only an invading infection, but will in turn continue to attack healthy cells and organs, thus causing inflammation. Therefore, anything that stimulates activity in my immune system can cause what is known as a lupus flare. Lupus is also slowly attacking my liver. I have a rare liver disease called nodular regenerative hyperplasia, which causes portal hypertension and bleeding varices in my esophagus. I have 2 AVMs in my stomach and another rare condition called GAVE. My liver GI issues are mild but progressive, and I have to be checked frequently. Lupus is considered to be an invisible illness, but I am here today to show you that I am not invisible and I do want to be heard. My health may be declining, but what helps me to thrive is the continuity of care, I have a hard time with those words, that has been provided to me by the Affordable Care Act. I am here to testify today that I am alive because of the Affordable Care Act. I am. So thank you. And I am grateful to be here. It's my pleasure to share my story. As someone who has successfully, President Trump, I was able to navigate the ACA myself. So if I could do it, anyone could do it. But I know how essential it is to protect our care. I also know that due to my advancing diagnoses, that my time may be limited. And that is not an easy thing for me to say, by the way. But that does not scare me at all. It only propels me to fight harder and stronger than ever.
Peter Morley, with his healthcare journey, shows the importance of the Affordable Care Act. And when the Senate voted down a repeal of Obamacare last Thursday in the middle of the night, he was there in Washington speaking with elected officials. Congressmember Carolyn Maloney says it's extremely tense on Capitol Hill because you don't know what's going to happen.
And it could happen not only with the repeal, it could happen with the budget process where they cut the subsidies, where they cut the support for states and for the exchanges and would deny people coverage in that way. So no one knows what's going to happen. I am just going to go back to Washington and continue to fight for affordable, available, and high-quality health care. We need to stop talking about repealing it and start talking about what we're going to do to make it stronger, more affordable, more available. We've covered many more people in America, but still only 10% are not covered. Only we've done a better job in New York State. 5% are not covered, but there are still people that aren't covered. We need to cover them. We're the richest country on earth. We should provide affordable and available health care for all of our people. And I'm hopeful that there'll be a movement to sit down and start talking about what we can do together to make the system better, not how we can sabotage it or hurt it or deprive people. It is necessary for the life of people like Peter. If he doesn't have his Medicaid in place, he doesn't have the payment for the treatments that he needs. So this is really life-saving. So we're dedicated. We're fortunate that we have a federal system and we can innovate on the state level. And the chairman of the Health Committee for the New York State Legislature, the Assembly, is here with us, Assemblyman Gottfried, who has some strong ideas of what we can do innovatively to move forward.
Well, in Washington, Representative Maloney and others are fighting to stop the Republicans from making everything worse, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare or health insurance, and hopefully patch up some of the gaps in the Affordable Care Act. But if we really want Americans to be entitled to health coverage and not suffer financially trying to get it, I think progressive states like New York have to enact improved Medicare for all laws here at the state level, while we're also fighting against the Republicans in Washington trying to make everything worse.
New York State Assembly member Dick Gottfried says activism can advance single-payer health care for all.
People need to talk to their state legislators, to write to the governor, to have every organization that you're part of take up this issue. If we build a really broad and strong base, we can overcome what will be the strong opposition of the insurance industry to get health care for all New Yorkers.
Carolyn Maloney.
I would say keep fighting, keep reaching out to your legislators and legislators across the country. If you have family in other states, call them, write them, tell their stories, and make sure Republicans that are voting against the Affordable Care Act know whose health care they're stealing, what it means for people. Medicaid is essential to provide health care to meet needy people, not only in New York State, but across the country. So all of us have a voice. Use your voice and make it loud and strong for health care.
If Trump makes good on his threat to end federal subsidies for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, it would significantly raise prices for consumers. Andrea Sears has more.
Those subsidies, totaling about $7 billion a year, help reduce copayments and deductibles for families with incomes of less than 250% of the federal poverty level. Frederick Isasi, executive director of Families USA, says ending those subsidies would throw millions of Americans off their insurance.
We could see many, many insurers pulling out of the private marketplaces. So many of the families that are relying on coverage through the Affordable Care Act could see coverage disappear almost instantaneously.
If the subsidies are stopped, rather than pulling out of the marketplaces, the insurance companies might simply raise prices. But according to Isasi, the effect would be about the same.
They would have to significantly increase premiums. Estimates are around 20%. So there could almost immediately be a 20% increase in premiums for America's families.
Ending the subsidies would also affect members of Congress whose insurance was moved to the exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. Isasi points out that if Trump does stop the subsidies, Congress could step in and authorize the payments.
The Congressional Budget Office has said because these payments are assumed in the budget baseline, it would be at no cost. It would be a very simple thing that could be done on unanimous consent if they wanted to.
He adds that unanimous consent would constitute a veto-proof majority. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York. Despite criticism and condemnation from the United States and its regional allies, Venezuelans woke up on Monday to a new constituent assembly, many say dramatically reshapes that South American nation's government. Sally O'Brien has more.
According to regional press reports, 8,089,320 votes were cast in Sunday's election, amid news that several regional neighbors were refusing to recognize the election results. The National Electoral Council said more than 8 million people turned out, a figure immediately disputed by the opposition, which claimed fewer than half that number had taken part. U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley led the criticism, calling the vote, quote, a sham election, quote, another step towards dictatorship. Those remarks quickly followed by Argentina, the second largest economy in South America and the most developed Latin American nation, considered a major non-NATO ally by the United States. Mexico, the U.S. largest trading partner, followed suit, as did Colombia, Peru, and Panama, all hosts to U.S. military bases and signatories to free trade agreements signed in 2008 under a program securing peace and prosperity from Canada to Chile, guided by then-Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. For its part, the European Union condemned, quote, the excessive and disproportionate use of force by security forces, prompting, it said, serious doubts of the election's legitimacy. In several parts of the country, violence did break out, resulting in at least 9 deaths. Opposition leaders are blaming state authorities for the violence, but Venezuelan authorities deny blame, citing many youth arrested over the past few months have said they were recruited by street guerrillas, violent, masked, and armed groups, which, according to the Prensa Latina news agency, almost always appear after protests called by the opposition, quote, to attack essential services. Quote, on May 9th, Venezuela's executive vice president presented national and international media with evidence of the link between these groups and the most reactionary Venezuelan right. Yesterday, Washington imposed sanctions against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, freezing any assets subject to U.S. jurisdiction and prohibiting U.S. citizens from doing business with him. The State Department says Washington will continue to take strong and swift actions against the architects, quote, of authoritarianism in Venezuela. And 2 days ago, Reuters reported, quote, the Trump administration is considering imposing U.S. sanctions on Venezuela's vital oil sector. But many are wondering exactly how those sanctions would play out. For many years, Washington has had strong relations with Venezuela's oligarchy, and Venezuela is the third largest provider of crude oil to the United States. In March 2015, when the Obama administration imposed new sanctions on Venezuela, U.S. News and World Report published an article entitled "How Not to Win Friends in Latin America," which questioned why the administration would do something that so obviously hurts the opposition in Venezuela. Quote, "The main opposition group, the Democratic Unity Roundtable, issued a statement that did not support the sanctions, saying Venezuela is not a threat to anyone." Maybe yesterday's sanctions were merely for show. Can Washington really impose broad-based sanctions on a country which they have so many historical ties, business and otherwise, to the huge oligarchy in Venezuela? Would they be sanctioning their own business interests? And the question must be asked, could this signal a return to the low-intensity warfare and covert ops which earmarked U.S. Latin American policy throughout the 1980s? Only time will tell. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Sally O'Brien.
Meanwhile, last Wednesday, Cuba marked the 64th anniversary of the July 26, 1953 rebel attack. It was led by Fidel and Raul Castro on the Moncada military barracks. While unsuccessful, the attack signaled the beginning of the Cuban Revolution, and it's celebrated as Revolution Day each year. Gilda Hill of Havana's Prensa Latina News Service reports.
Cuba will not step back, not even to get up speed. This 26th of July, Cuba marks one of the landmarks of its history, the day of national rebelliousness, the assault on Santiago de Cuba's Moncada Barracks and Carlos Manuel de Céspedes in Bayamo, Granma Province. These heroic deeds 64 years ago had as main objective to fight the evils of the dictatorship implanted by Fulgencio Batista in the island by a coup d'etat of March 10, 1952, and is considered the threshold of the struggle that led to the definitive victory of the Cuban Revolution in January 1959. On that day of 1953, a group of young revolutionaries led by the then young lawyer Fidel Castro proposed to promote an insurrectional climate in the country that revived the ideals of independence of the Cuban people. Though the assaults of the Moncada and Carlos Manuel de Céspedes barracks resulted in a defeat in the military order, it became a moral success because it marked the way to the later guerrilla warfare that ended with the triumph of the revolution in January 1959. As Commander-in-Chief Fidel Castro once said, the 26th of July actions opened a new way for the people, marking the start of a new fighting conception that soon after destroyed the military dictatorship and created the conditions for the later revolutionary victory. The 26th of July celebration is no doubt a form to perpetuate the road chosen by the people and its leaders since January 1959 and reaffirming the patriotic ideals of those that from the beginning of the struggles for independence in the 19th century sacrificed their lives to give Cuba complete sovereignty. However, this year's commemoration takes place in a context quite different from last year's, which was dedicated to the leader of the Cuban Revolution in his 90th birthday. As Cuban President Raúl Castro recently stated in his closing speech of the ninth period of ordinary sessions of the Cuban Parliament, 8th Legislature, in celebrating the National Rebellion Day for the first time without the physical presence of Comandante en Jefe of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro, "Let us propose to face the new challenges under the guidance of his example, his revolutionary intransigence, and eternal confidence in victory." And as to the challenges posed on Cuba of the new announcements made by current U.S. President Donald Trump last June 16, the Cuban Revolutionary Government said, "Cuba and the United States can cooperate and coexist, respecting our differences and promoting everything that benefits both countries and peoples. And to achieve this, Cuba will not make concessions essential to its sovereignty and independence. No matter what the government of the United States does or does not decide to do," the Cuban president added, we will continue advancing along the paths of sovereignty chosen by our people. Hilda Hill of Prensa Latina News Agency.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, August 1st, 2017. The news was produced with A. Kim Killick, Andrea Sears, Sally O'Brien, Gilda Hill, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York. And now, one more note. We need your support. We need you to phone WBAI and become a listener member. Say you're doing it for the WBAI Evening News. Say you're doing it for a listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station, which can bring you issues maybe not heard on mainstream media. Reggie, could you please explain to people how they can support this radio station? And I thank you.